I just want to make a couple of technical requests that mobile phones be silenced or turned off, please. And we are recording the event tonight. I need to say this for apparently legal purposes, so you're aware of that. And so when there's a question and answer period after Vita's lecture, there'll be an opportunity, you know, for people to have their ideas recorded. Vito Acconci was born in the Bronx, New York in 1940 and currently lives and works in Brooklyn, New York. In 1962, he received a BA and an MA from Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, and in 1964, an MFA from the University of Iowa, Iowa City, Iowa. Vito has had numerous exhibitions, far too many to list tonight, of course, at a range of institutions over the past 40 years, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim, Documenta, the Venice Biennale, the Pompidou, DIA, the Prato in Italy, the Mack Museum of Applied Arts in Vienna, the La Jolla Museum, now known as the Orange County Museum, the Serpentine Gallery in London, PS1, Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco, the Kitchen, the Stedelijk, MoCA Los Angeles, the Tate. He exhibited for many years at the Sonneman Gallery, as well as Barbara Gladstone Gallery, and Vito's work is in the collection of many institutions, MoMA, Centre Pompidou, Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, the Whitney, so on and so forth. Briefly, I just want to call out a number of key pieces by Vito. I had a longer introduction, but I think it's important for Vito to start as soon as possible because he is the main attraction. Just a few pieces. Following piece, seedbed, applications, rubbings, conversations, the red tapes, some works from the 1980s, including House of Cars, Bad Dream House, Bodies in the Park, House on the Ground. Acconci Studio, a truly interdisciplinary platform of design and building, was initiated in 1988. In the socially collaborative, fundamentally experimental context of the Acconci Studio, architecture and design are considered at once theoretical and practical processes. Architecture and design are utilized as mutable languages that can be strategically and tactically responsive to various social, cultural, and political situations, whether at Ground Zero in New York, or in the city of Graz in Austria, or technological conditions, the space of information. His public projects in architecture of the 1990s and this past decade include Personal Island, Personal River, Flying Floors for the Main Ticketing Pavilion, the Philadelphia Airport, Screens for a Walkway Between Buildings and Buses and Cars, Shibuya Station, Tokyo, Japan. Courtyard in the Wind, Moving Park, Buildings Department Administration, Munich. Wall Slide, Wall and Seating System, 161st Street, Subway Station, the Bronx, New York. Muir Island, Floating Cafe, Theater and Playground in Graz, Austria. United Bamboo Clothing Store in Tokyo. And so on and so forth. Among various accolades, in 2002, Vito was awarded an honorary doctorate of fine arts from the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. He has received ID Magazine's Award for Excellence in Design in 1998, 1999, and 2001. In 2002, Vito was the Robert Guathmey Chair at Cooper Union in New York. Vito will speak for about 90 minutes, and then we will have a question and answer from about 7:30 to somewhat after 8:30. Please welcome Vito Acconci.
Thank you. As Joshua said, the recent work is architecture and design, or we don't think of it as art. We think of it as architecture and design. It didn't start that way. But the work didn't start as art either. It started as writing. It started as poetry. So I want to give a kind of hopefully quick idea of how stuff started and why it eventually it eventually got to where it is. The work began as poetry in the mid 60s to late 60s. When I was writing, I was probably trying to make words do possibly what it couldn't do. I wanted words to be matter. I wanted words to be material. In other words, when you look at words, you're used to looking through words to content. I and a number of other people at that time wanted possibly to do something different. Could we make words be fact? In other words, the page was important. Movement over the page was important. When I was doing a poem in the late 60s, my start was, how do I move? How do I move from left margin to right margin? How do I move from top of the page to bottom? It seemed impossible then to use on a page a word like tree, a word like chair, because this referred to another space. A space off the page, where I wanted the reader to be traveling over a page, traveling from page to page. So if I couldn't use words like, if I couldn't use words or wouldn't use words that took you to another space, I would try to do words that placed you on the page, that took you over the page, here, there. I couldn't use tree or chair, but I could say in that place, at that time. After a while, I started to think of, I was so interested in movement. Why was I confining this movement to a page? There's a world out there, there's a floor out there, there's a ground out there. So at the end of the 60s, the work changed context. No longer writing, no longer a page, but an art context. Why an art context? Because at that time, at the end of the 60s, the way a lot of people thought about art was it wasn't so much a specific field, but it took from other fields. It could take from sociology, from psychology, from history, from news. So at the end of the 60s, the starting position I had was, I'm in real space. Now that I'm in actual space, what gives me a reason to move there? One example, a piece called Following Peace in 1969, done for a program called Streetworks, in which a number of people, some artists, some poets, were asked to do something over the course of a month, to do something involving the street, specifically New York streets. The piece I did had a very simple scheme. Each day, I would pick out at random a person in the street, a person walking. Each day, then, I would follow a different person, until that person entered a private place, home, office, whatever, so that following pieces would range from, say, 2 or 3 minute episodes when someone got into a car and I couldn't follow, ranging from that to, say, 7 or 8 hour episodes when someone went to a restaurant, a movie, etc. If you could apply a language to the pieces I was doing then, the language would be something like I, a person, an agent, attends to it, a world considered as if it's out there. How do I find some way to tie myself into that world, key myself into that world? In other words, I was trying to make myself a kind of passive receiver of somebody else's action. Maybe somebody else's action could take me where, that other person's action could take me where I hadn't planned to go. So in other words, I was setting up, the way work started for me was, let me set up a set of rules that determine my action, but don't determine the specifics of that action. The specifics are determined by something outside of me. after doing pieces like this for a while at the end of the 60s, I started to think that I had to, if I'm using my own person in pieces, and I want to make just a general note about person, why the use of my own person, and I wasn't the only person doing this, because I think the use of one's own person was because that's what the time was doing. The end of the 60s was a time in which the common language was finding oneself, as if the self is something that you wanted to withdraw from the rest of the world from in order to concentrate on the self. In other words, this was the kind of music of the time, Neil Young music, Van Morrison music, single voice, long song, giving the person enough time to find the self. So I started using then my own person. What seemed to be important about my own person was I had to find some way to make some interaction with you, the viewer. The way I wanted art to be, and I'm not sure if art can do this, was that it would set up some situation in which I faced you. One example, an activity, a performance piece in 1971 called Claim. It took place in a two-level space, street level and basement. On street level, next to the door leading downstairs to the basement, there's a video monitor, so that the monitor gives somebody an idea of what's going on in the basement. Person then decides whether or not to open the door, come downstairs. The piece is a three-hour piece. I'm seated on a chair at the foot of the stairs in the basement. I'm blindfolded, and I have with me two lead pipes and a crowbar. I'm talking, constantly talking, talking directed to myself, but talking aloud, saying things like, I'm alone here in the basement. Things like, I want to stay alone here in the basement. I don't want anybody to come down in the basement with me. I'll stop anybody from coming down in the basement with me. I'm alone here in the basement. I want to stay alone here in the basement. In other words, saying that kind of talk over and over again, drumming that talk into me as almost a kind of hypnotizing device, convincing myself that this basement is mine. So whenever I hear a person coming downstairs, I swing the lead pipe, swing the crowbar in front of me, as the title of the piece says, claiming this space. In retrospect, since the work did become design and architecture, this was probably, though I certainly didn't think of it this way, this was making some kind of private house, some kind of private space for me. Somebody else can't get in. Okay, what I liked about pieces like this was that I thought I was setting up a situation of meeting. An art occasion would be a situation where I faced you, where I met you, where person in the role of artist comes face to face with person in the role of viewer. At the same time, though, I started to be disturbed by a lot of these things, by a lot of things I was setting up. I set myself up as a kind of still point. A viewer has to go through lead pipes and crowbars in order to get to me. In other words, I thought I was setting up a situation of meeting, but a meeting should be between equals. And I'm starting to think that I'm setting up this glorified position for me. A viewer has to struggle in order to get for me. In other words, all the things I thought I hated about art as a kind of religion, an artwork as a kind of altar, an artist as a kind of priest, it started to seem to me that that's what my work was falling into. So there had to be some kind of change. And that change, I thought, had to come from thinking that maybe I wasn't a point in a space. If I'm a point in a space, I'm a focal point. If I'm a focal point, I'm this important thing in the space. I thought, maybe, why can't I be part of the space? Can I be part of the architecture of a room? Thinking like that led to a piece in the beginning of 1972, a piece called Seedbed, conventional gallery room, about 25 feet wide, about 45 feet long. Halfway across the room, the floor becomes a ramp. The floor rises to a height of about 2.5 feet, 3 feet at the far wall. The piece is performed, or the piece is activated for a number of days over a two-week period. Each day the piece is activated from opening time of the gallery to closing time. So a viewer walks into the room because the floor becomes a ramp, maybe without thinking about it too much, a person walks across the floor, starts to walk up the ramp. For that 8-hour period, I'm underneath the ramp. I'm underneath the floor, moving around under this floor where people are walking. And my attempt is to constantly masturbate in order to do so using viewers as help. Help in the sense that I hear people's footsteps on top of me. I can build sexual fantasies on those footsteps. Those sexual fantasies keep my activity going, keep my masturbation going. Every now and then, the masturbation reaches climax. Though the piece itself was going backwards since it was a kind of regression. Every once in a while, the masturbation reaches climax. A person on top of the floor might be thinking something like, oh, he's done this with me. He's done this for me. In any case, an attempt to join more private space under the ramp with more social space, more public space above the ramp. I didn't mention that my voice is coming up from under the ramp. So as a person is walking from under the ramp, a voice says, I'm doing this with the person on my left. I'm touching your hair. I'm running my hand down your back, etc. Okay, one or two things about Seedbed. I mentioned that it was done each day from opening time of the gallery to closing time. I mentioned that not so much to stress the endurance test quality of the project, though probably, like it or not, it was that. The opening time to closing time, the opening time to closing time made sense to me because it seemed that I had to be part of the room. I had to be part of the room as far as any viewer knew it. In other words, I couldn't, while viewers were there, go into and under this floor as if it was kind of a stage. I couldn't leave that floor while viewers were still there. So I had to be there before the first viewer got there, after the first viewer left. It was this kind of desperate attempt that could I become part of the architecture? But I certainly at that time wasn't thinking of myself doing architecture. What I think has always happened with work of mine is that it's never that I'm doing one thing and then I decide I want to do something else. It's more that the work starts to go in a certain direction and I start to realize that I have to kind of listen to what the work is saying. After all, I'm doing the work, so I must be saying this to myself. Okay. One thing that happened after Seedbed is that I started to wonder things like, if I'm not seen in the space, do I really have to be there at all? And I think that was a reflection of me having second thoughts of live activity, of so-called performance. And those second thoughts had to do with the fact that I started to wonder, has my work lost sight of its time? That language of finding oneself, this was the language of the late 60s, but it wasn't the late 60s anymore. It was 1972, 73, 74. I think people were starting to have a different notion of self. Self wasn't this precious jewel that you had to isolate yourself in order to examine. By the mid-70s, people, including me, were thinking more as the self exists as part of a social system, a cultural system, a political system. If you withdraw from everyday world in order to find yourself, maybe you find nothing. Maybe the self isn't anything. Maybe the self is only a social use of the self, a political use, a cultural use. So by the mid-70s, work changed. Work became what people were calling installations. Installation is a very vague, there were a lot of vague art terms. Installation was possibly the vaguest in the sense that anything is installed. A painting is installed, a piece of furniture is installed, a rug is installed. So I think at that time, those of us who were doing what, you know, it's always what other people were calling. I mean, I think the people who did this stuff probably never named it. And that might not be a good thing, because if we think we know what we're doing, we should help people by trying to name it. But at that time, I think if I, for example, who was doing installations, I had to try to figure out why am I doing this? What's important to it? What's important about an installation? And for me, there were two basic things. When I did a piece at this time, I never did a piece until a gallery or museum was giving me a show. Once a show was being given to me, I would try to examine the space and try to find the particular quirks of the space. In other words, it was important to me to find something that I could do in this space that possibly I couldn't do anywhere else. Ideally, I wanted to do, and this didn't always happen, but ideally I wanted to do an installation that once it was done here, could never be done anywhere else. Why was that so important? Because I hated the idea of art being considered a universal thing. I didn't believe and don't believe anything is universal. Something is considered universal maybe if it's approved by the power of culture at the time. So I wanted things to be very specific. This made sense in this particular space at this particular time. At another time, it probably doesn't make sense or would have to make another sense. The other thing that interested me in installations was that obviously there were people in these spaces. There were people in museum spaces, in gallery spaces. And I wanted to do something. The way I wanted to think of space was, this is a people's space. I wanted to make a place. I wanted to make a place not out of the space, but out of the space that people are using. One example of the installations was a 1976 piece called Where We Are Now, parentheses, who are we anyway. Done in Sonnabend Gallery at that time, the gallery in West Broadway, in Soho. The main entrance to the space was around the corner of the black room. You enter the room by the elevator. You walk around this kind of L-shaped corridor that takes you into what's usually used as the main room of the gallery. For the purpose of this piece,
The doorway to the gallery is blocked off. The outside of this room, not the gallery so much, the outside of this room painted black. Next to this black room is a long table, long wooden plank, stools on either side of the table. The table is propped up on the windowsill of the gallery, and then extends out of the gallery. So what began as a table at became a dining room. Or the way I saw it, whether anybody else saw it this way or not. When you do a project, obviously to do one, you're doing something for people, but you're also probably giving yourself a message. And I think at this time I wanted to give myself the message that I have to get out of here. I have to get out of galleries. I have to get out of the work rooms. In this case, there's a hanging stool on the table. There's a constant clock ticking. And as the clock is ticking, my voice comes in, now that we're all here together, and what do you think? Now that we've gone as far as we can go, and what do you think? Now that we're of the installations I did, this piece really interested me because I thought, wow, I have found a way to turn a gallery into something like a plaza, something like a town square. But at the same time, I thought, I really can't take it because a gallery or museum is never going to be a town square or a plaza. It's never going to be a public place. If I really think I need a public space, if I really think the work is heading towards a public space, I've got to find some way to get there. So the next few years, at the end of the 70s, was spent in trying to kind of reinvent architecture for myself. Stuff of mine had always been connected with the person, with the body. So in the beginning of the 80s, I did a number of pieces that tried to urge a visitor to the gallery to use the kinds of signs, use the kinds of vehicles in the gallery, the use of the instrument, or maybe make some kind of shelter, something like architecture. This was a piece in the beginning of 1980 called Instant House. So very often four kind of projects by American flag covered on the floor and hanging down in the middle of the swing. If a person sits on a swing, the swing starts to go down, and these panels are walls that start to rise up around the user. And the houses, the Instant Houses, an American flag house inside, associated flag house outside. So you have one kind of space for yourself, maybe another kind of space as an announcement for others. One thing I liked about these projects was that the house on the last is the longest person keeps the vehicle going, keeps the instrument going. When you get up from the swing, the panels are out, the walls go back down to their original position. So I like the fact of a person being connected with the durability of the house. At the same time, I realized that maybe a building, a house, is something that people have to go back to. It's not a performance piece. It's not an activity. Maybe an activity makes a house, but then the house is there for people to use it as they want. So gradually, towards the middle of the 80s, I started to make some outside connected to their house.
So our first proposal,
I was talking about the terms afterward, I stick to this,
so our first proposal was these two intersecting spirals.
I don't know
so one spiral makes one business house, the other spiral
at the same time. I've been used to doing that by others, because I've become an artist, a kind of artist, the notion for a while, because I've been really the fact that these people are collaborating, and get to the ideas I have, because I know that I'm working with people who know how to do this stuff. So in the back of my mind, the notion of maybe I can't be working
We had approximately $40,000 budget. But the storefront space is very, very narrow. It's at its widest point, it's 15 feet wide. Then it goes down to 5 feet. So we thought maybe we could renovate the space just by making a kind of new storefront. So we made a storefront. We made a storefront that was divided into parts. These parts then can hinge both vertically and horizontally. So if a part of the facade hinges horizontally, it can function as a table. It can function as maybe a sculpture, a stand, a form, a model. There's also sometimes a kind of continuous space from inside to outside. I have to admit, I know Stephen really loves this project. I can't say it's maybe a useful project in the spring and summer. It's a terrible space in the fall and winter. You know, one of the reasons architecture exists is because nature differs. So that maybe have to kind of take care of that. Okay. Other examples of change. Back to the coffee tea set. The way it works is from the transparent connectors, you take out cups. The cups and saucers. This spheroid has four flat points. So you roll it to a flat point. Now you can insert a cup inside. You press up. Now you have coffee. You rotate it then to another point. Another flat point, another flat spot. You can get milk, sugar, etc. Another example of change. Back to the Soul project, this floodable island. I mentioned that there are these hotel capsules on the island, in the crevices of the island, when the island floods. The hotel capsules now are floating in the water. Since it was only a first proposal, we didn't have to worry about things like, what if the flood lasts for 3 weeks? Though, in the back of our mind, we did have a solution. We thought one of these capsules could be a rescue boat, so could take people off the island. Another example of change, a project we did, again, I think more of a public art project. The project we were designing maybe in 97 was built in 2000. It's for the courtyard of the Munich Buildings Department Administration Building. The building itself has a tower, and there's, as I said, a courtyard in the middle. So the way we started was, could we do something with the highs and lows of this site? So since there was a tower, we installed a wind turbine on the top of the tower. So it's moved by the wind. It produces electricity. Down in the courtyard, one ring is cut out of the ground and it's placed on a turntable below ground. This turntable is activated by the electricity produced by the wind turbine on the tower, so that this ring of the courtyard is very, very slowly and very constantly moving. So that you might be standing on one side of the ring, somebody else is in the ring, you blow your nose and the person's gone. Or you look at a tree and then the tree is 10 feet away. Strangely, they realize that it's now providing electricity for half of the building. This was something that we had no idea would happen, but maybe we should start to deal with those things. Another example of change, there are some competitions that are called idea competitions. They're not thinking of building something, at least not now, but they're trying to gather ideas, maybe something might be built in the future. This was a proposal we were asked to make for an ideas competition for Strasbourg in France.
It was an ideas competition for a plaza in Strasbourg. We wanted to do a kind of plaza of plazas. Could we have a constantly changeable plaza? Does something have to remain the same? So we had these arcs that supported canopies, roofs, but these roofs could constantly shift. They could constantly go wherever there needed to be, if there needed to be shelter, if there needed to be shade. The arcs themselves were light carriers. Embedded in the ground was a track system, so all the furniture of the park could be moved. You're sitting on a chair here, you want to sit next to a person over there, you move your chair over. By that time, the person has inevitably moved away from you, but it's constantly like musical chairs, moving chairs. Chairs and tables could be moved, the tables could be moved together to make a marketplace. Tables could be moved together to make a platform for a stage. Seats moved together to make theater seating.
I've always had this name.
One of the things we had to be aware of was that anyway, the ground of this plaza couldn't bear very much. It couldn't bear much weight. But there's a parking garage underground. The parking garage has columns. So we, above ground, built these columns above ground, and it would be something that could support now a little pavilion-like building. It would close like a fan. It could open like a fan. It didn't have to be grounded. Grounded on the ground. Operation number 13 years or so, portable architecture, mobile architecture, back to the umbrella. It has some advantages over the conventional umbrella. You can tie either end, one end to your wrist, so you can carry things. You could wrap it around you like a kind of shawl, so there's maybe not an umbrella bumping problem. A second person can easily come in under the umbrella. Then because of the folding system, it should be able to fold down to something, you know, the size of your fist. We have to make a prototype of this. I don't know if it'll happen. One thing we love about clothing is that it's kind of like the architecture you take with you. I'm kind of convinced that the architecture of the future will be a constantly mobile architecture. I'm going back to the 90s again for a project we did in the 90s. In 1991, we did a project called Mobile Linear City, a conventional tractor and trailer. The trailer contains other units inside it. So when you get it to a place where you can park, you now pull these four other units out of this one unit, so it becomes five times its size, and it works pretty easily. You pull down the back legs of one unit. Now you drive the truck forward a little bit, put out the next set of legs, drive the truck forward a little bit. The walls hinge in, making furniture, tables and chairs, etc. The smallest unit is a service unit, so you have a stove, a toilet, etc. It has a particular quirk. This toilet that's folded down, when it's hinged up, the place is more private. The toilet is facing outside. If you need to use the toilet, you bring it down, but now your ass is exposed to the outside world. We've been trying to work on a
I tend to,
on a car that I think we have to give up. We came across, we wanted to try to make a car that doesn't need tires. It's based on a science, or maybe a pseudoscience called cymatics, in which the insertion of sound into a plane makes the plane ripple. The rippling of planes then could possibly cause motion. We were working with a physicist at MIT who said that he's proven it can go 15 miles an hour, but I think that means this is a fantasy. We love science fiction. We can't stand fantasy, because science fiction is an anticipation of the future. Fantasy is Never Never Land. This is Never Never Land. But it had some things we would love to pursue. We wanted the car to be a soft car, almost as if, you know, taking the idea of airbags and making the whole car of airbags, based on the principle that maybe the best way to meet impact is not by resisting it, but by bending and yielding. Also, the cars, we thought of maybe cars in the future could plug together. Not everybody wants to drive, so one person drives, everybody else goes to sleep.
Obviously, we want to do.
Okay, operation number 14, like a parasite, like a virus. I think, you know, designers of my generation, and I think generations after, were very struck by the Ridley Scott movie Blade Runner. Based on the Philip Dick story, for me, for example, it was a notion of science fiction that was the opposite of Stanley Kubrick's 2001. Not that I dislike that version, but that version was an all abstract future. Everything's all white. Everything is built as if from the ground up. The Blade Runner notion was that you could never have enough money to tear everything down. So why don't we build on what's already there? There are cities that already do this. You know, Rome did it. So the notion of architecture as a parasite on another architecture is something that's always on our mind. These were two pieces from the 90s, done for a museum show. We were asked to do some new projects. So outside the museum, we did a park up a building. There are these expandable rods that then can hook onto the top of the building, and they carry this kind of park. It has a companion piece, a house up a building that has portable shower, bath, etc., and it kind of takes electricity from the inside of the museum, which is probably what a parasite really should do. We tried to do a version of a parasite in Brazil in 2001. Brazil has been cut through by all these highways, elevated highways. Not all of Brazil, São Paulo. Sorry. Projects are done for particular cities, not for whole countries or whole worlds. I'm trying to go fast. When I go fast, I realize I'm leaving out words. Anyway, once there was this underside of the highway, we thought, can we do some kind of housing that clings onto the underside of the highway and can be used by, so it's lifted up off the street and can be used by people who maybe are forced to live on the street. The housing itself is on the underside of the highway, so it doesn't need a roof. But we thought if we extended it up next to the highway, now it becomes a kind of garden. So house under garden next to it, so that it's used by people. It's lit inside, and as a byproduct, it lights the neighborhood. neighborhood under the highway, which is potentially a kind of dangerous neighborhood. Now it would have a kind of lighting system. Here on one side, on the right side, people are sitting on a kind of bleacher system, watching a large television screen. On the other side is a kind of washing area, washing clothes, washing people. It's one of those projects that was supposed to have been built, but never was. This was never supposed to be built. A kind of parasite project we proposed a few years ago for a subway station in New York. Actually, maybe I'd like to allow time for conversation, so maybe we should skip some of these. It was an attempt to. It was an atrium space, and we thought, atriums are really attractive, but there's all this wasted space there. There's so much space and it can't be used for people. So we tried to turn the atrium in on itself. So there's still a narrow atrium in the middle, but now there's a space around it that can be used as this vertical park. There could be this spiraling park that people could use. Now, how often people would want to use a park while waiting for a subway? I'm not sure. So maybe we didn't count. We didn't count for something. We want the kinds of spaces that change. We want the kinds of spaces that maybe people cause. So another operation is emergence, growth, architecture from the bottom up, architecture from inside out. This is a project we're working on now in Indianapolis. It should be built next year. To tell the truth, it started because it was a relatively low-budget project, and we thought, and we can't really do much physically, so we started to think, we think we want to combine physical spaces and virtual spaces, but we haven't really touched very much virtual space, so this was maybe an attempt to. There's a street in Indianapolis that goes through a building. It's a parking lot. For the basketball arena. So it's a very, very populated space. There would be a different volume of color in the morning, in the afternoon, and at night, when cyclists, when people cycle through it or walk through it, there's a kind of mesh area around them that holds thousands of LED lights. So the people activate sensors that make this kind of swarm of LED lights, almost like fireflies around you. So if you have these fireflies around you, somebody else coming in the other direction has it, now you exchange fireflies, so that the space is constantly changing, constantly shifting. So this notion of attractors and repellents, these lights are attracted now to other lights, makes us think, can we do other things that way? We've been trying to think, can we make clothing based on the principle of attractors and repellents. We have started to try, but we don't really know. Last two or three operations, operation number 16, an architecture that feeds itself. Sometimes we worry about the stuff we do. We think, why are we making these spaces that are so curved, that are so folded in on itself? Everybody's doing spaces like that. Is there a reason for a space like that? There might be. If you have a space that curves in on itself, it starts to form a lot of wind inside. So it could be something maybe other than a wind turbine, which simply collects wind. You can possibly make a space that makes wind, that because of the different direction of the currents, you can make more wind than you had before. before. A way to do it would be you make the surface filled with millions of little hairs. So anytime one hair is affected, another hair is affected. So more and more wind is possibly Operation number 17, an architecture of air. This is a project that might be done next year for an art fair in Miami Beach. It would be made all of inflatables. The roof would be inflatables lifted by helium balloons. The furniture would be all of inflatable. This was a project we did for the Guggenheim Museum just recently. The Guggenheim asked about 250 architects and artists to, in effect, do a new Guggenheim, but only in design. So they did a show called Contemplating the Void. Can we rethink Frank Lloyd Wright's space? So we did a space that was filled with these kinds of stretchable, rubbery lines. It was based on the premise that the void in the Guggenheim is so inviting that it's hard to resist the idea of throwing yourself off the edge. You start to think maybe you could fly. So this would be a space where you could throw yourself off the edge, and you would be constantly caught up by these lines. These little bubbles in the middle are all the past and possibly future Guggenheim shows. So you can have them virtually. You can stick your head in and see the past, etc. Last operation 18, mix, swarm, multitudes. Back for a minute to the Soul Project. Now that the space is pushed in, there's all this extra space that's not used. Since we didn't do a green landscape outside, we could use these in-between spaces as a kind of jungle space inside. So you could be in a concert hall, you walk out of the concert hall, you walk through a jungle, you go to a restaurant, etc. Back to the World Trade Center, back to the World Trade Center project. Now that there are these, now that the building is riddled with holes, the holes make tunnels through the building, from one side to the other side, tunnels from bottom to top, and vice versa. Now that there are tunnels, the rest of the city can come inside. Parks can come inside the building. Street vendors can come inside the building. In other words, instead of observing the convention, a building can be built a few stories higher if they have a so-called public space in front, but the public space in front is public only if you obey the rules of the corporation. We're trying to propose, can there be a mix of public and private space? For example, that grayish column at the left of the image is an elevator shaft going from office to office. These white columns are waterfalls going from park to park. The notion of mix is, I think, the most important notion to us. Maybe it's not so great if a space is just totally public. Maybe if there's a so-called public space, what can people do there except maybe have lunch or maybe be gathered together and become a kind of totalitarian space? A leader stands up and gathers. Now, sometimes I think public spaces in the city are places where people, where the city can get a large number of people together so they can easily run surveillance cameras on them, so they know where their children are. So maybe a new public space is different. A new public space is alleys, is back rooms, is the internet, etc. Okay, why don't we turn the lights on and see if we can talk. See if we can talk. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.